Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody. I'm Stephen Sheehan, and I am definitely an alcoholic and an addict. Any crackheads in the house? Huh? Oh, I love me some crackhead, boy. Yeah. And anyways, I'm gonna spend a little bit of time. My alcohol and my addiction were my alcoholism and addiction was fed by a lot of childhood trauma. Okay. I was born in Houston in 1969. I just celebrated my 50th birthday. I know. Yeah, y'all wish y'all looked this good when you get 50, huh? Yeah. Anyway, so, some of my earliest memories of drugs and alcohol, my mom was a Bandidos Bikers girl. I never knew my real father. And my mom was a party girl, you know? And I can remember when I was a toddler, you know, they didn't have ADHD back then, you know? And so when I went to go visit my grandmother, and my grandmother would make me her special OJs, you know, little screwdrivers and shit, you know? And I can remember I was, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years old, running around my grandmother's living room with a cigarette in one hand and a screwdriver in the other hand. You know, singing Freddie Fender, "Wasted Days and Wasted Nights." Yes, I got a few people in here that know it. Yeah. So, you know, and I loved it. You know, and I got to just kind of just do whatever I wanted to do. You know, and I can remember when the times when my mom couldn't get my grandmother to watch me, that she would take me in tow, and. When I was with my mom and her boyfriends, you know, we used to play this game called Puff the Magic Dragon. And my job was to break up the weed so we could play Puff the Magic Dragon. And so I would separate all that shit real good, you know. And then, you know, when they'd get ready, they'd say, "Come here, Stevie, you ready? You ready?" And I'd blow all my hair out, and they'd give me a big old shotgun. I'd be stoned. I'd curl up in the corner, you know, with my teddy bear, and I was out of there, you know. And anyways, needless to say, one of my earliest God memories, and in my story, I'm going to talk about God because I believe in God and I believe in Jesus. I'm born again Christian. I'm a tongue talking, Bible thumping, you know, Holy Ghost feel. You know what I'm saying? You know, full baptized immersed Jesus freak. Okay, so just let's get that straight. First of all. Second of all, my first experience with God, I was about 6 years old, and one of my mom's boyfriends was watching my sister and I, and I don't remember what I had done wrong, but he had been down there working on his motorcycle, and he came upstairs, and he proceeded to punish me. And the way he punished me was that he made me stand up on my tiptoe and he made a dot where my nose touched the door, you know, on my tiptoe. And he made me stand there with my nose in that dot. And every time my nose came out of that dot, he had the cable off the motorcycle brake that he was working on, and that sumbitch whooped me with it for about 15, 20 minutes. And I can remember at 6 years old, after this whooping, I ran in my bedroom and I crawled up under my bed and I grabbed my little bitty old pocket knife that was about this big and I grabbed my Bible. And I remember stabbing my Bible until all the pages were just kind of coming out, you know. Because how could a God of love and compassion and care and all that good stuff that they talk about God is let this happen to a 6-year-old little boy, you know. And that was my first experience with God. Anyways, my mom, she was a drug addict, and we wind up in Denver, and she put me and my sister on a plane to my aunt and uncle's for Christmas. That was back in 1977. I hadn't seen her since. You know, I don't know where she is. You know, do I think about her all the time? Did I have a lot of resentments? Do I got a lot of work that I did behind it? Fuck yeah. You know? And, but, you know, the thing is, so I went to live with my aunt and uncle, and it was a totally different ball game. There was no drinking, and there was no, you know, no weed, you know, being blowed in my face. And my uncle was a pretty good alcoholic, bad alcoholic, whatever you call it. He was a good alcoholic, I guess. And, you know, and I can remember that because I didn't really have any, I didn't have any structure living with my mother, I was a behavioral fucking nightmare. Excuse my language. I was a behavioral nightmare, you know, and I was always in trouble, always in trouble. And the thing was, is that I had suffered enough abuses, you know, already in my life, that when my uncle was ready to discipline me and drug me out there to the garage and whoop my ass with that belt, you know, I knew that as soon as that whooping was over, the slate was clean and I could act a fool again. You know what I'm saying? Until I drove them to that point, they want to drag me back out there in the garage, you know? And I can remember there was one point, you know, in these, you know, and this was a regular thing, you know, at least once every week, 2 weeks, you know, some shit like that, you know. And I remember one night my uncle was particularly drunk and he whooped me particularly hard and I wound up pissing myself. And he looked at me in such disgust that the whooping stopped. So I learned that if I went in the back, when I got drugged to the garage, if I just went ahead and peed myself real quick, that the whooping wouldn't be near as long, you know? And, you know, so I always had a way to figure out how to get around the system, you know? I was always going to get around the system some kind of way. There's a loophole. There's something that I can make you feel sorry for me enough that I can get what I want. You know, what I like to refer to it as emotional currency, you know? And so anyways, my aunt and uncle, you know, I was in third grade. I was in third grade and I went to live with my aunt and uncle. And I don't remember. I got a wild hair up my ass, and I decided that I was going to burn down the school. And so that night, I got me a big old thing, or a little thing, a lighter fluid for the Zippo lighters. And so the next day, they went to school, and so I asked the teacher, could I go to the bathroom, and she let me go. So I went into the bathroom, and I took this lighter fluid. And I took all the paper and all the toilet paper and all the paper towels and I spread them all out over the bathroom. And I took this lighter fluid and I squirted it all over everywhere. And I lit a match and I went, threw it in there and it went, whoof. And I walked back to class, cool as a cucumber. I was like, you know. And the next thing you know, the fire alarm and whatnot. And so they start shaking down the school. You know what I'm saying? It's major shakedown here, you know. And I realized, oh, shit, I still got the matches in my pocket. I was like, shit, I got to get rid of this. You know, I wasn't a very good criminal back then, you know. And so I take these matches and I try to throw them behind the bookcase. And this little boy sees me and he sneaks me out. And see, I was so not good as a criminal that I had used the matches from the racket club that my uncle was the owner of, you know. So there wasn't really any denying. I don't know, those are my matches, you know. And so anyways, needless to say, I was expelled, never to come back to Clear Lake Elementary School ever again. And so my aunt and uncle, they didn't really know what to do. And so they built a house in Friendswood, you know, 20 miles away. And they were going to give Stevie a new, you know, new lease on life and, you know, new school, new people, new kids, whatnots. And, you know, and so I'm in the fourth grade. And there was a series of events that happened. You know, like I said, I was a behavioral nightmare. And anyways, long and short of it was, the final straw was that my teacher, who was about 6 months pregnant, I had already thrown a desk at her once earlier in the year. And she had said something to me one day that I didn't like. And I looked at my teacher and I told her that I would kick her in the stomach and kill her unborn child. And they said, that kid can never come back to the school ever again. Strike two, you know what I'm saying? So my aunt and uncle, they didn't know what to do. You know, I'm going to, you know, they're sitting, you know, I'm going to a shrink, and, you know, I can't go to school because I can't go to school because I can't behave myself. And so they had no choice but to send me to a place called Cal Farley's Boys Ranch out in Amarillo. And anyway, I got there. It was in February of 1980, and I was 10 years old. And, you know, in the dorms, there's 24 dorms, and the dorms range, in each dorm there's 24 boys, and the ages range from age 10 to the age 18. And so when you're placed there, your deal is pretty much you're going to be there till you graduate or till you turn 18, whichever comes first. And I was there, I don't know, 30 days, and I got raped. The first 30 days I was there. And this continued, you know, off and on for the next couple of years until I was big enough and old enough to get away, fight my way out, you know what I'm saying, kind of deal. So by the time I was 11, I had pretty much suffered all the abuse from my aunt and uncle and them telling me that I was a piece of shit. I was just like my Uncle Norman, just like my mama. I was a loser. I wasn't going to amount to shit. You know, the verbal and the mental abuse, not to mention the physical abuse and the sexual abuse, you know. So at 11 years old, I just wanted to die. Just wanted to die, you know. And the thing is that when I went to Boys Ranch, you know, we had to go to church twice on Sunday, once on Wednesdays, and then Tuesdays and Thursdays we had Bible study, you know. And so now I'm hearing about, you know, God and now how I'm responsible for my soul and I'm at that age where, you know, you're no longer covered by the prayers of your parents and blah, blah. And I'm thinking, I ain't got no parents, you know. So, like, I'm forever fucked and gone to hell anyway, right? So, and, you know, and the thing is here's the whole thing about the concept of God is because I can remember as a child, you know, they told me that the Tooth Fairy was real. They told me that the Easter Bunny was real. And they even told me that Santa Claus was fucking real. Excuse my language. You know, they told me these people were real. And I believed them. And now all of a sudden, now they're telling me here's this God that's real. But he's the same. You can't see him. You can't hear him. You can't taste him. You can't touch him. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, that sounds like a duping to me. You know, you ain't going to okey-doke me. You know what I'm saying? You already got me with those other three. So when I guess I was 11 years old, and our dorm parent used to make us do these the Bible Memory Association deal. And if you did all your, you know, assignments right, you got to go to church camp for 1 week in the summertime. And so So anyways, that's where I first met Jesus, and I accepted Christ as my personal Lord and Savior at 11 years old at a church camp in Ringo, Louisiana. And you know, I thought when I did that all of a sudden that life was going to be peaches and creams and roses and all that good stuff, you know? And it just simply wasn't that way, you know? And so I spent a lot of years in boys' school until I was 15. My aunt and uncle brought me out, you know. And during all that time, I learned the scripture real well. I didn't understand any of it, and I didn't know how to apply any of it to my life. But I understood it real. I mean, I knew it. I learned it, you know, read it, tried to memorize it, all of that stuff. And so, I guess, so my aunt and uncle brought me back at 15 to live at home. I was in high school, and it was my sophomore year in high school. And it just so happens that the high school principal at Friendswood High was the principal that I had in elementary school. So I got called to the principal's office the first day of school. And she says, Mr. Sheehan, we're not going to have any repeats of what we had in elementary school, are we? And I said, no, ma'am. And So, you know, of course, you know, my aunt and uncle, they had kids the same age as my sister and I. And so my brother, I call him my brother. He's really my cousin by birth. He's 4 months older than me. He, you know, introduced me to my first beer, you know, my first weed, cocaine, ecstasy, all that, you know. And so within 4 months of me coming back home out of boys' school, my aunt and uncle wanted me to go back to boys' school, you know. And so my aunt had pulled me to the side, and she told me that she said that my uncle was thinking about leaving, and that it was either me or him, you know. And I needed to start thinking about that. And so, you know, I ran away. I ran away at 16 in the state of Texas. You know, that's you get arrested for that, you know. You get arrested for being a runaway. And so my uncle had dropped custody of me. The state picked up custody of me. And I went through five, you know, shelters in 3 months. I got kicked out of all of those. And so the thing is, you know, from the time I was 13 until later, I'll get to that point, rage. Rage was my drug, you know. Because I have such a high tolerance for pain, you know what I'm saying? I like to fight. I used to like to fight. Hell, I used to like to get my ass whooped. Shit. That shit felt good sometimes. You know what I mean? I know that sounds bad, but yeah, it was right. You know? But the truth of the matter was that I had a lot of rage, so I didn't lose a lot, you know? But it was a drug in itself, you know? And so I can remember Child Protective Services sent me to a group home out in West Texas, out by Fort Davis, and called High Frontier. And I was there for, I don't know, about 3 months. I was 16, and I decided to kill myself. I hung myself in a tree. Still got that scar goes all the way from ear to ear. Hung in a tree for about 20 minutes before they could cut me out. I was in a coma for about 3 days. And paralyzed the whole right side of my face for about 6 months. And that was about the only thing, you know. I don't remember much of it. I just remember that I tried to do it, and I was unsuccessful. And so I got kicked out of group home at 17. Child Protective Services came and picked me up, and they took me back down to Galveston, where I was from. And they couldn't put me in jail because I hadn't committed a crime there, and they couldn't put me in juvenile because I was 17. So they emancipated me, and they took me to the corner of 23rd and Broadway in Galveston, Texas, and they dropped me off in front of the Salvation Army, and they told me to have a good life, kid, you know? And I didn't have any job experience. I didn't have no family that wanted nothing to do with me. I didn't have no money, and I had a backpack full of clothes, you know? That's how I started my journey in life. And that day, I told myself, I said, never again will any sumbitch ever tell me what to do, you know? And so at 17, you know, after this happened, shortly after that, I took a bunch of pills. I tried to slice my wrist. They found me on the seawall, and they took me to the adult psych ward. I failed again, you know? And so anyways, I started robbing and stealing and selling drugs and doing all that bullshit. Wound up in prison, you know. Did 14 months on that. I had 72 charges. I had three of them from the Organized Crime Control Unit there in Galveston. And anyways, because I had never been in trouble before, and my lawyer, I was her very first case ever, you know, my public defender. And she went in there and told the judge about my sad-ass story. So I got 5 8-year sentences all run concurrent. So it was like 1 8-year sentence, and I did 14 months on it, and they kicked me out. And because I'm such a role model inmate, I went from minimum custody to medium custody to maximum custody, you know, in a short period of 6 months, you know. And anyway, they kicked me off of closed custody, you know what I'm saying? I was happy to have it. You know, I said, shit, I'm gone. Shit, make a mistake. I'm out. Gone. Peace. Anyway, so I'm out. I get out, and I'm, you know, go right back to, you know, selling dope and robbing and stealing and doing all the other bullshit. So I wind up back in prison again in 1990. For the second time, and they gave me a 10-year sentence for stealing a car. And so instead of doing any, they sent me straight to maximum security. I went to Ferguson unit, you know. And back in them days, it was rocking and rolling. And, you know, and I was young, pretty, and white, but I still walked out with my butthole tight. You know what I'm saying? So I tell you, I got a few bees, you know what I'm saying? Don't let them sting you, you know what I mean? Anyway, long story short, you know, hello. Now, can you hear? While I was there, I had this girl that I dated before I went in or whatever, and I thought she was the love of my life, kind of bullshit, and she had sent me a Dear John letter basically telling me that she was pregnant with some other dude's baby, and, you know, I decided at that moment that, you know, I didn't want to live again, you know? And so that night I took my sheet and I tore it into 2-inch strips and I braided it, you know, and I tied it to my locker and I jumped up and down on it and it held. So the next morning when they rolled the doors, I had my commissary bag and I stepped out and the boss, what are you doing? I said, I'm going home today. I said, I'm either going out of here on parole or in a body bag. Your choice is yours. And so I then ran down to the other end of the run and I climbed up into the 4-row window. And I started to tie the rope off. And so I was down there, and I was tying the rope off, and they come down there, and they're like, come down here and stop playing games. And I'm like, oh, you think it's a fucking game? And I let go. Don't ask me how, but the rope broke, right? So I'm up there, and I fall, and one of my legs get caught in the window, and it turns me upside down, and I fall about 25 feet, and I land headfirst on the concrete. And it was one of those situations where if you've ever been put to sleep, you know, you kind of wake up and you're disoriented and shit. So I'm laying on the run like in a heap of bones, you know, and I got this big Fred Flintstone on the back of my head, you know, and I kind of come to and I'm looking around trying to get my bearings of what's going on. And I was like, damn it, boy. You know, when you fail at the ultimate failure, you wake up and your self-esteem's pretty much in the shitter, dude. I don't care who you are, you know? So at that point in my life, I realized, you know, maybe God has something different for me. You know what I'm saying? Because I really tried to check out. I have literally, seriously tried to check out 3 times and it didn't work, you know? And I didn't know what God's plan was. I really never thought that I would make it to 25 years old, you know. I did 5 years and 2 months on a 10-9 aggravated sentence at Ferguson because I'm a role model inmate, you know. And so anyways, I got out. I was 25, and I started living differently, you know. But the thing was, is that during all that time of incarceration and when I was in group home and all that stuff, I didn't have no drugs and alcohol. You know, I had that brief 4 months or whatever with my brother where I had drugs and alcohol, you know. But the thing was, is rage and anger was my drug of choice, you know. So, I mean, I was one of those guys that when I got out of prison, I mean, when I was at the light, and I looked over, and you were staring at me too long at the light. I jumped out. I put it in park, and I come over, and I slap your head off. You're just, what are you looking at, bitch? What you going to do? You know? I had problems, man, like seriously problems, you know? And you know, and then the person behind them would be looking at me, and I'm like, I'm just checking them hoes, you know? Kind of bullshit, you know? And so, you know, I was out of prison about 1 year, and my oldest daughter was born. She just recently graduated college from Southwest here. Yeah, I remember when they handed me her. That was the first thing that I felt like that I'd ever done right in my life. When they handed me that child, you know, and that child was the reason that I told that felonious line so many times and wouldn't step over. I mean, I stepped over a few times, but I told that line very good, you know. Anyways, you know, I started drinking and, you know, smoking pot and doing all that shit, you know, what we all do. And So what I really want to get to is, and I don't want to spend a whole bunch of time, you know, my drug of choice was rage. And then when I had the choice to get drugs and alcohol were my medicine. Drugs and alcohol saved my life. And the reason that drugs and alcohol saved my life is because I was destined to kill myself without drugs and alcohol. Because I hated myself so much. I hated all the things that had happened to me. And all the things that I just told y'all about, I didn't tell nobody that shit till I was 30, man. Hell, even my wife that had two kids, I had not told her none of those secrets and shit. All that stuff. And I carried this around. And nobody knew. I lived two different lives, you know. My ex-wife, she was Pentecostal preacher's daughter, third generation raised up on a church pew. I'm third generation, hell, heathen, demon seed, spawn of Satan himself, you know. And the thing was is that, you know, but I still took my kids to church every Sunday. And I was involved in the church. And I lived two different lives, you know. And it was a continual, just trying to cover my tracks and, you know, lying and manipulating and, oh, my God. You know, I checked myself into treatment the first time. Let me back up real quick. So I can remember during, I think it was in 98, 99, my wife had called, or my ex-wife had called me, and I was at work or whatever, and she said, "Some brother so-and-so's got a church, and do you want to go to church?" I said, "I got to go to church." And so I'd gone to church, and I went to this church. I'd never been here before, and, singing and praising and clapping and whatnot, and then the pastor dismissed the musicians from the platform, and he said, "This is a time of service where if you got something you need to talk about, you need to pray about to God, we'll get one of our prayer warriors, come down here and pray with you. Come on down, let's pray with you." And I already knew what time it was. I had already stepped out, walked down to the front, and I'm down there. And I'm standing there, and I got my head bowed, my eyes closed, and my arms crossed, just like this, you know. And I'm silently petitioning God. And I'm telling God, you know, my marriage is on the rocks. I got this cocaine addiction. I found out my family been lying to me and all this shit. I'm just unloading on God. And I'm just standing there just like this. And all of a sudden, I had this thought, came from nowhere, that I had a shield in this hand and a sword in this hand, right? And I think to myself, I say, "Stephen, you're committable, dude." You know, because here you are, you're in church, you're praying, and now all of a sudden you think Conan the Barbarian and shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, dude, you're crazy, you know? And so I took this thought, and I dismissed it as complete lunacy, and I got back to my prayer, and I'm still standing just like this. I haven't moved, and I haven't said a word. This guy walks up behind me, and he says, "Stephen, God told me to tell you he put a sword in your hand." And I'm telling you, at that moment in my life, I realized the God that I had accepted and been praying to, that I didn't understand, knew me personally. Knew me personally. Right? One of the things that I'd always believed in, you know, I read the Bible and it says, if you think it, you know, so is your heart. You know what I'm saying? That which is, you know. And I thought, well, he can see what I do, but he don't know what, you know, what I'm thinking. But at that moment, I don't know about none of y'all. I've never met a mind reader. You ever met a mind reader? Anybody? Yeah? No? I haven't met a mind reader. This guy just told me what I'm thinking. And not only that, he knew my name. I've never been to this church. What's really going on? You know what I'm saying? And so, anyways, I was then convicted with all the thoughts of all of the revenge of all the people that had done me wrong and all the times that I had lit them on fire and then put them out and then lit them on fire again and shit, you know? In a way that I had some really sick thoughts of revenge of all the people that had done me wrong as a child, you know, and how I wanted to get back at them. So fast forward, 2003, I've already been to treatment, went to treatment. I was in treatment, and the first time that I checked myself into treatment, I was standing in, I was in the shower in my room and took a shower, and I was sitting there and I was praying to God, and I said, "God, you know, I can't do this." I said, because all of these secrets and all this shit, you know, it's like fucking leeches just sucking the life out of my soul. I can't do it. I can't look in the mirror. I can't stand who I am. I just want to die. But I've got kids, and you know what I'm saying? I got a life, and you know what I'm saying? And how is that going to affect them? And I just want to check out, you know? And God tweaked my perception in a moment. He says, you're looking at it all wrong, you know? Well, do enlighten me, please. You know what I'm saying? And he says, you know, in the physical realm, when we send soldiers out to battle, you know what I'm saying? If they do make it back, you know what I'm saying? If they do make it back, we give them medals. We give them medals of Purple Hearts and valor and honor and, you know, courage and all that, you know. So when you walk out there and they're dressed to their nines on the parade ground, right, that you can walk down there and they got all those medals on their parade uniform, and that you can walk down there and you don't even have to know that cat's name, that you can look and see how decorated he is, that you know that's the sumbitch you want in your foxhole when the shit goes down. You know what I'm saying? You don't even have to know his name. And he says, Stephen, it's the same thing in the spiritual realm. He says, you've come through all these things. I've brought you through all these things. He says, but the thing is that the devil likes to use doubt and shame and guilt and fear and remorse and self-loathing and worry, right? Those are all the tools. And see, the thing is all these things that you have, you're not talking about them to nobody, so you're allowing those to have power over you. He says, flip the script. You know what I'm saying? He says, you're a highly decorated spiritual warrior, boy. And I was like, okay. All right. You know? Okay. You know, but that still didn't change my life. I still couldn't stay sober. I still couldn't change my life, you know. So then, you know, fast forward, I go through treatment and go through treatment a second time. And, you know, if you're ever worried about getting out of treatment, you know what I'm saying? You know, I got out of treatment the second time I went to treatment. I went to try to kind of save my marriage or whatever. And the day I got out of treatment, you know, my wife goes, I want a divorce. And I'm taking the kids and, oh, by the way, I've got a boyfriend. And I'm like, bitch, I've only been gone 30 days. Shit, you know? And anyway, so, yeah, try that out when you get out of treatment. You know what I'm saying? That's a good one, you know? So I went straight to my sober house here in Austin. That's when I moved here to Austin. I went straight to the Willowick house, and I cried and cried and cried and cried. And I cried for 6 fucking months. And those guys at that house every night about 6 or 7 o'clock would find me curl up in the fetal position, cry my eyes out, you know. But I wouldn't do the work. Wouldn't do the work, you know. So in January of 2004, I was to be officially divorced. I'm singing in choir at the church. You know, I'm paying my tithes. I'm going to church. I'm going to work. I'm going to meetings that I have to go to. They've made me the president of the Willowick house. And I'm getting to see my kids occasionally, you know, every other weekend or something. So I decided to go to a different church. And on the way to church that day, I said, God, you're going to give me something today. And I'm driving to church, and I go to a different church I don't normally go to. And I'm punching the roof of my truck because I'm so mad at God, you know, and because I feel like I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, and nothing's happening, you know. And I'm mad at God. I'm like, if you don't give me something today, I'm done. I'm done with you, you know. And so I go to church over on 51st Street, Promised Land over there. And I catch that early morning service. And I walk in, and it was the same situation. You know, they're singing and clapping and praising and, you know, worshiping. And the pastor says, hey, if you got something you need to pray about, come on down to the front. And, of course, I didn't hesitate. I walked straight down there. And I walked down there, and I bowed my head, and I closed my eyes, and I crossed my arms. And I was standing there praying, and this guy walks up behind me, and he says, I don't know who you are, but God told me to tell you, you still have the sword. So not once, but twice in my life, I've had situations where God has showed up for me in a dramatic way for me to know that my God is as real as this concrete. You know what I'm saying? You know? So, need to say, that still didn't help me stay sober. You know? Because, see, the thing I couldn't figure out is why I would go to church and I would praise and I would go to, you know, sing in the choir and I was doing everything and paying my tithes and doing all this stuff, but I couldn't stay sober. I felt like God was leaving me. You know what I'm saying? But this is what I do know, right? I came to Austin Recovery four times, didn't stay sober. Had a great sponsor one time. She told me, she said, "You willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Take your shirt off, turn it inside out, wear it backwards all day." She goes, "If anybody asks you why you're wearing it that way, you tell them that you're going to any lengths to stay sober." And you know what? I did it. I did it that day. I damn so did. And I'll do it again, you know? So I don't want to spend any more time about the whole shit. I want to talk about from when I sobered up this time, right? One of the things I have on, I can remember my first day of sobriety. I'm at the Northland Group. If any of y'all don't know, if you're in your first 90 days of sobriety and you need a sober place to hang out and you can hang out there all day, go to Northland. You can hang out there all day. Nobody's going to ask you no questions. The only thing you have to do is go into a meeting if there's a meeting going on, right? Just know that. Northland is a safe place to hang out in early sobriety, okay? So I'm at Northland. I've been there a few times. It's my first day of sobriety. And this old lady comes up to me after the noon meeting. I'm sitting out there on the couch in the hallway, and she goes, "Stephen, I've been watching you come in and out of here for 5 years. She goes, "You don't let these old motherfuckers run you off this time." And I was like, I'm thinking to myself, this 75-year-old lady talking like that. I said, "But you're speaking my language, woman. You know what I'm saying?" And she goes, "I know you're sleeping under that bridge over there at 2222 Mopac right now." She goes, "You don't sleep under that bridge no more." She says, "You come over here. After 10 o'clock, this place is locked up." She says, "You bring your ass over here at 10:30. She says, "You go out there and you sleep on one of them park benches back there in the back. Or you sleep back there on the back porch." She said, "Don't be up walking around and doing all the bullshit." She said, "But bring your ass here. Stay here on this property. Don't go over there no more." I said, "Yes, ma'am." Later on that afternoon, I'm out there in the back smoking a cigarette, and I look over there, and there's a couple of pillows and like a couple of moving blankets that are stacked up on top of the ladders out there. No, they just magically got there. You know what I'm saying, right? You know? I know who put them there or who got them put there, right? Second day. So my first day of sobriety, I walked in, and I told this guy, Jay, I said, "Hey, look." I said, "Man, I said, I don't know how to do this." I said, "But I know I've been doing it long enough. I've been in enough treatment centers and all that bullshit." I said, "I know I need a temporary sponsor till I find one." I said, "Are you willing to be my temporary sponsor?" He said, "Let's talk after the meeting." So after the meeting, we talked for a bit, and he's taking me through steps 1, 2, and 3. And he's like, "Well, are you done?" I was like, "Well, yeah, I've said that 1,000 times." He said, "Well, how do you feel about God?" And so I started explaining to him about all the shit that I know about God, you know, because, I mean, two, three times that I went to the 6 times of rehab, they called me Pastor Rehab. You know what I'm saying? You know, there's still some guys that they see me, they say, "Hey, Pastor Rehab, what's up, dog?" You know? Anyway, so I'm sitting there and I'm talking to him, and he says, "You know, it sounds to me like you know that Bible pretty well, Stephen." He says, "Sounds to me like you know that Bible better than my pastor does." I said, yeah. He said, "But how's that keeping you sober?" I said, "It ain't." He said, "Let me ask you a question." He says, "Are you willing to be uncomfortable for a few days?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Are you willing to do what I ask you to do?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Just don't drink today." I said, "Yes, sir." I said, "But I'm hungry, man. I ain't got no money." See, I was one of those guys. I used to come to the meeting. I'd give you my sad-ass story so that way you would give me some money. You know what I'm saying? I'd go get something to eat or go get me another pint of whiskey. Shit, you know? And it was emotional currency. I could get you to feel sorry for me if I told you about my poor-ass childhood, you know? And I used that for many years, you know? Anyway, so he gave me $20. He said, "Just don't drink. Don't go buy no drink with it." And he says, "Show up and stay sober tonight." I said, "Yes, sir, I will." And I did. And so I showed up the next day at the 7:30 meeting. I slip on the side of that building, and I rolled off of the concrete onto the dirt and did the third step prayer on my knees. And I've been doing that every morning for the past 6+ years. You know what I'm saying? Of all the things that I know that I've done differently this time in sobriety, you know, is the fact that every morning I hit my knees and do the third step prayer on my knees, and I just don't put that shit in my body no matter what. Business partner fucked me over, the girl left me, blah, you know what I'm saying? I'll go to a meeting and tell y'all how I want to kill myself. You know what I'm saying? But I ain't going to put that shit in my body. You know? Because closed mouth never got fed. And what that means is if I don't tell you that I'm going fucking crazy, then you don't know I'm going crazy. And I can't go tell the world out there, you know what I'm saying, about the shit that goes on in here. I got to come tell y'all, because y'all the only ones that get me. You know what I'm saying? Y'all the only ones that get me. Because if I do that, if I go out there and tell y'all, tell them that shit, guess what? I'm back in Shell Creek again. You know what I'm saying? You know? For how many times? Shit, I don't know. Half a dozen of those, you know. Shoal Creek, Austin State Hospital, you know. Hey, just one thing. Just know, you can't strip off all your clothes and walk butt naked down the street preaching the word of God in Travis County. They will take you to Shoal Creek, I promise. I promise you that. You know. So, you know, so anyways, That second day, I was, you know, I showed up, and so after the meeting, Jay took me to his house so I could work off that $20 he gave me so I could mow his yard. So I went over there and I mowed his yard. And by then, you know, I had a big old fro, you know what I'm saying? I fro, right? I put it out there, too. I take it, I'll poof it out, you know? And anyway, Jay looked at me, and he said, man, you need a hair? He said, you want to get a haircut? I said, no, not my hair, no, you know? That's my signature, dude. You know, that's my identity, my crazy hair. You know? And, of course, you know, I did his yard, and he took me back up there to the club, and I hung out or whatever. And so at noon, this lady, a little old lady about this big, Miss Janice, walked up to me. She goes, hey, do you need some clothes? She goes, I got a whole bunch of stuff. I cleaned out my husband's closet and my son's closet. She goes, I got a bunch of clothes. I think you'll love them. I was like, sure. So after the meeting, she like lassos me, takes me out there to her car, you know. And she looks at me. She goes, would you like a haircut? And I'm like, well, obviously I need a haircut because you're the second person that's asked me that today. And she goes, well, you know I cut hair. And I'm thinking, lady, I don't know you from Adam, you know. She's like, well, when would be a good time? When would you like to get your haircut? I said, I don't know. I'm thinking to myself, I'm so busy under the bridge, I don't know if I can pencil you in, you know? And so, you know, and she takes these shirts, and she's like holding them up for me and whatnot. And, you know, I said, Miss Janice, I said, this is all real nice and everything, and I appreciate you being kind to me. I said, but I got two backpacks in there full of dirty clothes. I said, I don't need no more clothes to drag around here. I said, more than anything, I said, I haven't showered in over a week. And I said, and I can smell myself. And if I can smell myself, I know other people can smell me. And I said, and I don't feel good about that. I said, I'm very self-conscious right now. And I just want to crawl back up in the fucking woods. She looked at me. She says, you go get your bags right now. And this woman took me to her house. In the absence of her husband, in the absence of her son, and she took me there to her house, and she set up the shower deal or whatever. I got to take a shower. She made me some sandwich, she made me some food, you know what I'm saying, fed me. She cut my hair, and then she took all my dirty clothes and my dirty tennis shoes, and she washed, dried, and folded everything that I owned and brought it up to the 5:30 meeting and handed it to me. Now, we're talking about a woman who's 60-plus years old and weighs maybe 100 pounds soaking wet. And the thing that crossed my mind, I was like, this woman's God must be huge because she didn't know me from Adam, you know. And she wasn't talking AA. She was showing me AA. There's a big difference to sit up in that room and talk for an hour or to actually get out here in the streets and get in the firing line of life that the book talks about and start dragging people up out of the gutters. You know what I'm saying? You know what? And guess what? Sometimes when you drag people up out of the gutters, you get shit on you. You know what I'm saying? People shit on you. They don't be grateful. They don't say thank you. They might take your shit. You know what I'm saying? But you know what my sponsor said? Do it anyway. Do it anyway. Just keep doing it. You know? I'm like, well, that's bullshit. He said, no, you want to go back out there to that jungle? Shit, fuck that. No, I don't want none of that, you know. And see, the thing is, for me, you know, there was another time. So I'm a little bit, so how much time I got left? About 5 minutes? All right, so I'm going to try to wrap this up best I can here. So I'm gonna give you all a few things that my sponsor gave me that works for me. Number one is that we just always say yes. Chris texted me yesterday morning at, 9 o'clock. I didn't even have my first cup of coffee in me. You know? He's like, hey, man, you can't tell your story on Austin Curry tomorrow? And I'm like, well, shit, that's a lot of notice, buddy. But I didn't say that. What I did say was, let me get a cup of coffee in me and I'll call you back, you know? And so I said, sure, you know, because we just say yes. And if we just say yes, then we're not in our own shit. And guess what? There's a lot of times I move people, drive people. I do all kind of shit for people that I really don't. I don't want to do that. And sometimes I do it for people I don't even like, you know. But I just do it anyway. I just do it anyway, you know. Because, and I'm going to give you a little snippet. I had a sponsor here, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, man. And he was out there and he calls me on a Friday afternoon. Right? Called me on a Friday afternoon, and the bottom has fallen out of the sky, and it is pouring down rain. Pouring down rain. And he calls me from some strange phone number, right? It says, man, I burned my life to the ground again. I'm downtown by the coffee shop on 6th Street of Congress. He says, man, can you help me? And I just crawl in bed after a full day of work. I'm about to take my nap, dog. You know what I'm saying? Old man need a nap. Shit. So I get my fat ass in my truck, and I drive down there in the middle of the rain on a Friday afternoon in the traffic, and I get out of my truck, and I go find his ass, and I bring him back to my truck, and we're driving back to my house. And he says, man, I can't believe you showed up. I can't believe you came to rescue me. Hey, why do you do that? I said, motherfucker, I'm trying to stay sober, dog. You know what I'm saying? I ain't trying to go back out there. I ain't trying to do that. Do I want to do this shit? Hell no. But I will, you know. I tell you, you know, here's another thing. I guess I was about 8 months sober, and this guy I was working with, my first year sobriety, my sponsor said, I don't want you getting a vehicle, because every time you get a vehicle, you wind up on the east side. You know what I mean? They said, you wait a year. And I was like, that's bullshit. You know? And so anyways, I was riding with this guy I was working with, and we were driving down to Boulevard, working on his job. And he asked me one day, he said, Steven, he said, what's the longest you've ever had sober? And I said, I don't know. Honestly, because I picked up a few dirty 9 month chips, 6 month chips, because I was in a sober house. You know, I can't get kicked out of the sober house. You know, you got to play that, you know, you got to play that role. And anyway, he said, what's the longest you ever been sober? I said, I don't know. Honestly, probably, 7.5 months or so. He said, how much time you got now? I said, I don't know, a little over 8 months. He goes, ooh, sounds to me like you're breaking records every day. And when he said that shit, I don't know if any of y'all ever seen that movie Hellraiser, like where the box like moves and shit, you know? Something in my mind did that, you know? Because no longer did I have to play the misery tape of where Stephen Sheehan winds up when he does get that great idea that it might be able to go get some crack and some scallywag bullshit, you know what I'm saying? You know, I don't no longer have to play the misery tape of living under the bridge, you know? Now I get to play the accomplishment tape of, I've never been this far. But I don't know about any of y'all. I know one thing. It's much, much easier to stay sober than it is to get sober. Y'all can keep all that get sober shit all you want. I don't want none of that action. I'm done with that getting sober bullshit, dude. You know? I'll say this, you know, my life today is better than I thought it could ever be. And I'll tell you this, is that I've never in my life, I've lived in the same address for 5.5 years. Hell, I was in the penitentiary 5.5 years, never lived in the same address. I got the same address for 5.5 years, man. You know, I'm self-employed, all my shit's paid. It's not about the things. It's about the people. It's about the friendships that I make. It's about the people that I see to come in and I get to watch the lights come on and watch their lives change, you know? And I'll tell you the greatest thing about staying sober And I mean, Erica was sitting there that day. This guy walks up to me, and I came out here and played kickball one day, man. And this guy asked me for a cigarette. And I always bring an extra pack because I was that some bitch begging for cigarettes and shit. You know what I'm saying? When I was here, because I'm broke. I ain't got nobody. You know, I was that dude. So when he asked me, I said, man, you ain't gonna know. Oh, so I said, come on, dog. So I take him over to the truck. I give him an extra pack of cigarettes. I said, here you go. I said, here's $10, man. Go get you some sodas and shit, man. Don't let them high cap on you, dog. Right? And so he comes up to me. It's 6 months later. We're at the alumni reunion deal. And he walks up to me and he says, dude, you changed my life. He said, that day, I thought everybody was full of shit. He said, but you showed me that people aren't full of shit, that there's some good ones in here. You know what I'm saying? So look around and look at these people. You know what I'm saying? There's good people here. And there's people that are serious. And you know what? I don't have to know you to care about whether or not you stay sober. I do. I want everybody to stay sober. I want everybody to feel the freedom that I feel on a daily basis. Is it easy? No, it's not always easy. You know? And I'll give you the last thing I'm going to say. My sponsor told me like this. He said, every day's the same. Every day's the same. And I'll tell you why. Because, see, tomorrow I may go have this. I may win the lotto. I may get, you know what I'm saying? Great. Everything just goes my way. I get the good job. You know what I'm saying? Girlfriend and I are on A1. Everything's perfect, you know? And then all of a sudden, the next day will just be a normal old run-of-the-mill regular day. And all of a sudden, I think, oh, shit, it's a bad day. It's a bad day because it's not living up to the expectation of yesterday. You know, my sponsor said, it's like a kite. When you have those really, really great days, you know, you remember you'd be flying a kite and it keeps getting up there and you're like, shit, and you keep letting the string go. And he said, reach up there and reel that shit in. Reach up. He said, still have a good day. But reach up and reel that shit in because you're going to need some of that shit tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? You're going to need some of that shit tomorrow. Last thing. I need somebody to help me. Anybody. Come on, Kiko. So look here. This is what I know about sobriety. Each day is paper thin. I would like you to take this piece of paper and I would like you to tear it in half the best you can. All right? Now, I would like to take you and do it again. Down the middle, right? Okay? Down the middle the best you can. Right? Down the middle, best you can.
Starting to get harder.
Down the middle, best you can. Right? Down the middle, best you can. What? All right, so no. So look, here's the thing. Look, every day's a little different. Some are smaller, some are harder. You know what I'm saying? Every day's a little different. We do the best we can to tear that bitch down the middle. And if we put enough of them together, you can't take it away.